It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and we start your state capitol report this morning with the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Credit Union League. They cite 117 different credit unions across our state, employing more than 10,000 people and serving more than 3.5 million members. Disclosures show Wisconsin Credit Union League is one of Wisconsin's most active lobbying organizations with a list of legislative priorities. So are you a member of a credit union? And what do you want to know about their mission, their advocacy, and their effectiveness? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 with your questions, or you can email us ideas at WPR.org. President and CEO of the Wisconsin Credit Union League, Brett Thompson, joins us this morning. Now, he joined the league back in 2001. Brett, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, your work with credit unions goes back almost 30 years now, though, doesn't it?
Actually, probably even a little longer. Prior to coming to the league in 2001, I also was in the private practice of law and represented a number of credit unions. So it is probably closer to maybe 35 years now.
So what is it, Brett, that draws you to that has kept you with credit unions for so long and now has you leading the Wisconsin Credit Union League?
You know, for me, it's really that unique mission of credit unions. You know, they're not-for-profit cooperative financial institutions that are owned by their members instead of shareholders. And in that role as a nonprofit, earnings then from the credit unions is returned directly to their members in the form of better rates, fewer fees, and improved services. That's borne out, or my real affinity to work with credit unions is borne out by the fact that in 2021, credit unions kept over $430 million in their members' pockets through those better loan rates, fewer fees, and member patronage. That's one side of it, Lee. The other side of it is also those unusual services that credit unions can offer that truly make them unique. And those are driven by what is the statutory definition of a credit union, which in part is to provide an opportunity for its members to improve their economic and social condition. That means credit unions do things like operate 100 in-school branches run by students to provide valuable financial education and a place to save for those students. That's just one small example. Other examples include small dollar loans of under $500 and special loan programs.
So, Brett, when it comes to developing the priorities of the Wisconsin League of Credit Unions, it sounds like that would be, as you mentioned, part of the cooperative institution's work. That would be the members' priorities that become the Credit Union League's priorities?
Yes, that's exactly it. Because credit unions focus on serving their members and not shareholders, essentially what we're doing is we are the voice of those members when it comes to legislative priorities.
So what are some of those top priorities that you see, Brett Thompson, from the Wisconsin Credit Union League?
Yeah, I think I'll mention two kind of broader policy issues that we're dedicated to tackling. One is elder financial abuse. Mm-hmm. In broad terms, in the last session, there was a bill that allowed financial institutions the opportunity to take some action to prevent the financial abuse. That included delaying transactions, offering time to investigate, prove to a member who was involved that it is potentially fraudulent, the transaction they want to go through with, and then to also involve potentially trusted individuals who know that particular member. This is appealing to us as credit unions because, and in addition, I should say also to banks, because they're on the front lines, capable of helping to prevent abuse like this, as well as knowing their customer or knowing their member. It's a particular interest to credit unions because they exist, as you mentioned, to serve their members, and the bill allowed for some thoughtful intervention that in some cases might prevent a member from being involved in fraud. So one area that our members are very interested in us engaging in and that we would plan to engage in this next legislative session, to the extent that the bill I mentioned comes back again, and we expect it to. The other area is in the area of payday lending. Based on a survey we did in 2021, 97% of Wisconsin's credit unions refinanced payday loan debt obtained elsewhere. Mm. So that is telling to us in the sense that it is our members who need our assistance directly in many cases as it relates to a payday loan. The payday loan industry in Wisconsin has not been subject to a cap on the interest rates they can charge, like is true in most other states. So the bill in question from the last session that we would certainly support limited the interest rate that a payday loan licensee could charge before its maturity date to 36% interest. Hardly a small interest rate, but in comparison to what they're charging today, which often can be in the hundreds of percent, it's a step in the right direction.
We're talking about the priorities for the Wisconsin League of Credit Unions this morning, and there are more than 100 credit unions in Wisconsin with more than 3.5 million members. Our guest, Brett Thompson, is the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Credit Union League. And if you have a question about your credit union or the role they play and the work they do to establish their priorities in Wisconsin, 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation, 1-800-642-1234. So in your time with the credit unions, when you look at the priorities that the members have presented to the credit League of Credit Unions, what do you see as some of the successes and what do you see as some of the priorities that perhaps you would have liked to have seen furthered but did not get far enough in Wisconsin state government?
Yeah. So certainly the two I mentioned are coming back after not having passed in the past. So payday lending as well as the elder financial abuse. And so we're gonna keep at those two to make sure we can take that across the finish line. In some cases, we haven't always been successful in our efforts to keep the laws that are applicable to credit unions current. And what I mean by current, Wisconsin has one of the oldest credit union statutes in the country. In fact, the first credit union in Wisconsin was formed almost 100 years ago now, well before a credit union could be formed under federal law. That legislation didn't pass until 1934. So it is imperative, given how long credit unions have been in existence in Wisconsin, how important they are to people's financial success and to the Wisconsin economy, that from time to time, we update our statutes to reflect the current day, the current events, the current issues that credit unions are facing. Generally, we've been successful in getting that done in the past. We look forward, though, going forward to reintroducing or dealing with issues that were not passed during the last legislative session that we think are really important to keep credit unions engaged in solving their members' financial problems.
Brett Thompson, president and CEO of the Wisconsin Credit Union League. In addition to his role at the League, he also serves as the board chair of the Credit Union House in D.C. and serves on the boards of the National Credit Union Foundation. If you have a question about the credit unions in your community, join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation with Brett Thompson continues. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. This is your State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and who in Wisconsin is advocating for financial literacy? Who's pushing for protections against elder abuse and payday loans? Plus, how do you systematically go about accomplishing those goals in Wisconsin? Our guest is here to answer that. Brett Thompson's a president and CEO of the Wisconsin Credit Union League, and we invite you into our conversation this morning at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We're Mike and Franklin standing by. Mike, good morning. You're on the air with Brett Thompson.
Good morning. I just wanted to share some information. I became aware of a federal credit union that has a couple of offices in the Milwaukee area. It's called Self Help. And one of the things that I value about it, and I've taken some of my own dollars and moved them over to Self Help, is that besides doing things for communities, they have an office on the north side of Milwaukee, an office on the south side, to provide services to communities that are likely underserved from a banking standpoint. They also provide a lot of information for financial literacy. I put my money there because I know now the money is going to be going into communities that could really use some help in getting dollars available for auto loans and mortgage loans. And these offices are also in places where they're going to have people serving the community that look like them. English language is a problem on the south side for a number of individuals, so that they have individuals there that will then communicate to people in Spanish so they can feel more comfortable doing their banking in places where maybe that was not something that was very welcomed in their community.
Mike, it sounds like you feel good about where your money's at.
Oh, I absolutely do. And I like to invest in the community, and I saw an opportunity there to do that. I have a history with credit unions myself in the way that they do a really good job of providing services.
Yeah.
That maybe I didn't necessarily get a really good response from the regular bank.
Hey, Mike, thank you so much for the call. And Brett Thompson, what you hear there is I think goes to the heart of the mission that unique mission that you've talked about that credit unions have. But can you explain the difference between a federal credit union and state credit union?
Absolutely. So a federal credit union and a state credit union have many of the same regulatory restrictions, because as to state credit unions, and in Wisconsin, 97% of all of the credit unions in Wisconsin are state chartered. But as state chartered institutions that are federally insured, they also have to follow the federal regulations that a federal credit union must follow. So in simple terms, a state chartered credit union is actually chartered here in Wisconsin under Wisconsin law. A federal credit union is chartered under federal law. Lee, could I just take a moment and kind of expand what Mike was saying in terms of unique services?
Yeah, you bet.
It's a great example. Self-Help is an organization that does a wonderful job in its work that goes on throughout the country. There are other great examples of that kind of service that is aimed at helping those who are underserved. One example of that is credit unions who have developed a special loan program that assists domestic violence victims get back on their feet as they start that next chapter in their life. There are also credit unions that, you know, have had members who are impacted by recent storms that have hit the state of Wisconsin. And some of those credit unions offer to their members 0% loan programs to get them back on their feet after suffering property damage. Still yet another example of that would be credit unions that are working with the incarcerated who are about to be released, who have done their time, and they've developed special educational programs that prepare those who are incarcerated for life after being incarcerated, and to make sure they get off to a good start.
Brett Thompson, President and CEO of the Wisconsin Credit Union League, taking your questions and comments this morning at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Where we go now to Colleen, who calls us from the Oakdale Credit Union this morning. Good morning, Colleen. You're on the air with Brett Thompson.
Good morning. Hello, Brett.
Good morning, Colleen.
I wanted to share, just to thank the League for the work that they're doing on elder abuse, and maybe give a testimonial and a suggestion for the listeners. we do see this very often, more than people can imagine. So my suggestion is, yes, keep up the good work legislative-wise, legislators on elder abuse, to allow credit unions to step in where needed. But also maybe a suggestion to watch your parents and get some help from family members. And that's what the legislative efforts allow us to do, is to reach out to some family members when we see things that maybe their parents or grandparents aren't seeing that they should.
So this legislation, at least as you see it, Colleen, would give you some agency on behalf of your members, especially the older ones?
Yes.
And elder abuse is something that you say that you have come across in your work before, and this legislation would help you in your work?
You know, I can tell you we're having an employee meeting tonight with some special training, because we're seeing it very, very often.
Wow. Colleen, I thank you for that heads up and that alert to all of us. Brett Thompson, there is another angle to this, however, and that is the American Bankers Association, who says credit unions take billions of dollars a year in taxes, buying up small community banks and moving them into a not-for-profit status. There has been some question about the not-for-profit status for credit unions, but how do you see it with your longtime work with the credit unions and your leadership with the Credit Union League?
Appreciate that question. It just first, it kind of has two components. One, the American Bankers Association comments regarding credit unions buying up small banks. The blunt reality is, although that happens, less than 1% of all the bank assets sold since 2012, and that may be a little bit higher, but it isn't much higher, have been purchased by credit unions. So it really isn't a problem in the sense of, in reality, credit unions buying up banks. I also would remind our banking friends that it's banks who have made the decision to sell to credit unions. But apart from that, the other part of that question dealt with credit unions' tax exemption. And, that exemption is based on the fact that as a not-for-profit financial cooperative owned by members, shares its earnings with its members in the form of better rates, fewer fees, and improved services, credit unions have received their tax exemption. That tax exemption turns out to be an excellent deal for Wisconsin citizens and those who are members of credit unions. I mentioned earlier that in 2021 alone, credit unions kept over $430 million in their members' pockets because of those better loan rates, fewer fees, and member patronage. The flip side to that is the American Bankers Association, the Wisconsin Bankers Association, often talks about taxing credit unions because it's an unfair advantage. The reality is that the tax that would be accumulated by a taxing credit unions is far smaller than the actual benefit that accrues to the public. The benefit, that $430 million, is something like 11 times what would be collected if credit unions were taxed. The Bankers Association also likes to talk about this in terms of the credit unions being taxed. The blunt reality is, if you tax a credit union, you're taxing its member owners. So it's another way of increasing the tax burden on individuals in the state of Wisconsin. That just doesn't make sense given the amount of benefit that accrues to our members.
Brett Thompson, where do you see the Wisconsin Credit Union League going in the future? And what's on the agenda next as we look past? And I appreciate the call about from Colleen about elder financial abuse and what they're doing tonight and meeting about it as a team, training with it. The call for curbing some of the interest, at least finding a cap for the interest rate in payday lending. What's next for the agenda of the league?
I think what's next on our agenda, which is kind of consistently always on our agenda, is the continuing updating and improving of our existing state laws, our existing state regulations, to make sure they still make sense in an ever-changing economic environment, as well as many of the things. I mean, the last 2 to 3 years with our pandemic and so forth are a great example of how anybody operating in that environment needs to have flexibility so that they can serve their members and they can survive. Credit unions showed great resiliency through that, many of them doing all of their services, whether it was a loan closing or other related paperwork, through a drive-thru. And they met their member needs, and it's that kind of resiliency we would love to see reflected maybe in some potential legislation going forward to clarify existing practices, to state existing practices, so that credit unions can be comfortable relying on that advice.
Hey, Brett, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Brett Thompson, president and CEO of the Wisconsin Credit Union League. In addition to his role at the league, he serves as the board chair of the Credit Union House in D.C. and serves on the boards of the National Credit Union Foundation. Up next, open records and the question about who has access to them. Do you? Well, we'll take a look at it as we continue your state capital report, and we invite you to join us. I'm Lee Rayburn. You're listening to The Morning Show. It's your state capital report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And to get you up to speed quickly, three judges have now ordered former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman to stop deleting documents having to do with his 2020 election review. Two judges have now found Assembly Speaker Robin Voss in violation of the state's public records law by not turning over documents having to do with Gableman's 2020 election review. While the chair of the Assembly Elections Committee on Friday once again called for decertifying Wisconsin's 2020 presidential election results. So do you want to see these documents in question? Do we, the people, have any right to see those documents? What do you think? Join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. That phone number again, 1-800-642-1234. Our guest is Tom Kamenick, president and founder of the Wisconsin Transparency Project, a law firm dedicated to strict enforcement of the state's open records and open meetings laws. Tom, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me on. And you missed that one of the judges also held Gableman and Voss in contempt of court for not turning over records.
It is. So let us start right there, Tom. Are those records that exist and are those records that the public have a right to see?
Yes, the Office of Special Counsel is a legislative creation. So it is a part of the government. So it is subject to Wisconsin's open records laws. And interestingly, even if it wasn't itself a government agency, because it is something that contracts with the government, its records related to that contract would be subject to the law as well. Those are all public records.
And Tom, if you've been following, can you give us some idea of what the defense of the former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman has been and what the defense of Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has been in failing to turn over these documents?
Oh boy, there have been a bunch, because there are, I believe, now four separate cases proceeding through the courts. They've tried to argue they're not subject to the open records law, or they don't have to turn over records because it's an ongoing investigation, but there is no such exception for ongoing investigations. They've tried to order that, or at least Voss has tried to argue that, well, I can't make Gableman search for records. There have been all kinds of things, and judges have not accepted any of them as legitimate excuses.
At least to date. Tom, how did you get involved in this? I mean, it could seem a little wonky. It seems like sometimes you might be wading through the weeds or at least looking for a needle in a haystack when it comes to open records. But this certainly strikes while the iron is hot this morning with the stories of the investigation into the 2020 election.
Sure. I've been a more of a bystander on this one. None of these are my cases. They're all being brought by the Pines Bach law firm out of Madison and by an attorney who's done a ton of great work for transparency in the state named Krista Westerberg.
And so, but how did you get involved in the open records, I mean, push? How did you become the founder of the Wisconsin Transparency Project? What made this all happen for you?
Well, anybody who's looked into my background would realize the irony here is I actually clerked for Justice Gableman when he was on the Supreme Court back in 2009-2010. It was that term. And it was an interesting experience, but one of the cases was an open records case, one called Schill versus Wisconsin Rapid School District, and it was about purely personal emails sent on government accounts from government computers, whether or not those could those could be turned over. And I got really interested in that. And I joined, after clerking, I joined the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And there I was the open records and open meeting specialist. And I got to do several cases up through the Court of Appeals and in the lower courts on those issues, and one even to the Supreme Court. And I loved it. And I realized at some point, this is what I want to do full time. And at Will, that was just one of many things I was working on. So I left to form the Wisconsin Transparency Project.
Well, we're talking about public records and why it's sometimes difficult to get officials to turn them over. Tom Kamenick, our guest, president and founder of the Wisconsin Transparency Project. And your questions are welcome during our state capitol report at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Tom Kamenick, which records aren't public? Are not public under Wisconsin state law?
Well, you got to start with a presumption that everything that's in government possession that has information on it is a record and by default is presumed to be open to public inspection, public copying. But there are a good number of exceptions, and the first set of them come from statutes. So things like FERPA and HIPAA protecting education records or medical records. There are statutes that protect things like your bank account info, other private info that government can't turn over about you. Then there's a set of court-created exceptions. For example, prosecutor files are pretty much off limits. There are the particular privileges like attorney-client privilege. So when your local mayor or your school board is having communications and getting advice from their attorneys, that advice typically is privileged and you can't see that. But then there's also what's called the balancing test. And this is something that gets applied on a case-by-case basis where the custodians of the records have to look at them and say, well, we weigh the interests favoring disclosure against the interests favoring non-disclosure and see which one weights more heavily. And so you get a lot of gray areas when it comes to that. You get a lot of denials that are based on that balancing test.
And then who decides the test and the outcome? Is this all take place in the courts? And where is enforcement when it comes to public records in Wisconsin law?
It all starts with that government custodian. They make the first decision. And if you believe that their decision is wrong, if you were denied a records request or information was redacted, you can go to court to challenge those. And that's where I come in. And that's also where the district attorneys, your local district attorneys and the state attorney general theoretically can bring these prosecutions too, although they rarely do. And if a case winds up in court, then at that point, it's the judge's job to do this balancing test themselves and see if they agree with the record custodian. And it's important that the record custodian is the one that has to prove that this exception applies. They have to show evidence that releasing these records is likely to cause some kind of harm to somebody's safety or privacy, or it would interfere with an ongoing investigation. They can't just allege that it will happen and it'll be taken at face value. They do have to prove it in court.
Have any of those defenses come up in any of the cases regarding Michael Gableman or Robin Voss?
Yeah, because they have argued that that this is an ongoing investigation. That's a common misconception. I see a lot of denials that just say, especially from police departments, oh, well, we're investigating this case. We can't turn over any records. That's not really correct. They're supposed to look at the records on an individual basis and decide, would releasing this record interfere with the investigation somehow? So, for example, you know, if somebody doesn't know they're a target yet and they're worried that they'll flee or they'll start destroying evidence or they'll change their behaviors, then the police or whoever's doing the investigation can make the decision and say, we're not going to turn this over now because it would make our job a lot harder. So that came up a little bit in one or two of the Gableman cases, but the judge did not accept those because Gableman could not show how releasing the records that he was receiving would interfere with his investigation.
Tom Kamenick, president and founder of the Wisconsin Transparency Project. How would you size up our state's public records laws? How do they compare and contrast to other states across the country? And are they doing the job that they're charged with for the public good?
there's parts that are better than other states. There's parts that are worse than other states. On whole, I'd say we're better than most states. It is difficult because literally all 50 states get to create their own rules about this. But we have laws that say it applies to every single branch of government, both the executive branch, the legislative, and the judicial branches. A lot of states' court records aren't open, or it only applies to state agencies and not local governments. We've got pretty good enforcement laws if you file a lawsuit in court and you win, you're successful, you get your attorney's fees paid by the other side. That's a great way that incentivizes actually enforcing these laws. There's some things that are worse, though. One of them is fees, because we have kind of open-ended, non-capped fees for locations. So the government custodian can charge you for the time spent looking for records, which tends to incentivize them to not be very efficient about their record searches. And I see a lot of really, really large location fee demands when they're not really called for, when they're not really justified. And I think it's really a way to discourage people from making record requests.
And Tom, as you see it, how are officials violating the state's public records laws? Where do they fall short most often?
What I mentioned before was especially law enforcement officials tend to grab onto this. Oh, it's an ongoing investigation. It's a really quick way to just say no, but it's not right. I do see a lot of those location fees being inflated beyond reasonable amounts, especially when people make a record request for electronic records, and you can literally just do a keyword search for emails in a couple seconds, and they'll still try to charge you for several hours of work. A lot of the times that's because they're trying to include time spent reviewing the records after they've done the search to see what might need to be withheld or information that might need to be redacted out of the records. But courts have ruled that they can't do that. They're not supposed to be charging you for time spent redacting or even just reviewing records after they've located them.
Who's making these records requests, Tom?
I see a lot of individuals who are local, especially at the local level, that get interested in whatever's going on at their local town halls or city councils. Something doesn't quite smell right. So, you know, a deal that's maybe in the works that's been a little secretive, people looking into that. Sometimes those people come together and form little local government watchdog groups. I get a lot of contacts from those kind of small organizations who were formed after some shady dealings or strange goings on, and people decided to look into it. But we also see a lot from the media, of course. I mean, if you're reporting about government, how do you find out what government is doing for you? You make the requests, you ask the questions, you try to see records. One of my first cases here at the Transparency Project was on behalf of Fox 6 News, which made a record request to Governor Evers, just wanted to see all of his emails for a short time period, you know, a week, or eventually it was even just a day. And the governor said, no, we don't want to turn those over because there's no search terms. You're just getting everything. You don't need to see that. But the courts disagreed and said, no, you get to do that kind of a spot check and look, just see who all is the governor communicating with. What is he talking about? Or what are people asking him?
Tom Kamenick is the president and founder of the Wisconsin Transparency Project. And have you met resistance when trying to access public records? Share your story this morning. It's the State Capitol Report, and you're welcome to join us at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our conversation with Tom continues on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're examining open records laws in Wisconsin, as they've certainly been in the news recently. But laws are written by legislators who are able to codify, if they want to, their own reluctance to grant public access or oversight. But open records requests can go over the line, too, can't they? Aren't there some public records requests that would have to be considered so onerous as to border on harassment? Some clerks, hardworking clerks, may be able to attest to that. So then where do you draw the line when it comes to the right of the public to see our government's work? 1-800-642-1234 to join us. 1-800-642-1234. Our guest, Tom Kamenick, president and founder of the Wisconsin Transparency Project. He also clerked for former Justice Michael Gableman when he was on the state Supreme Court, and was the open records guy for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Tom, you don't see, I take it, you don't see open records as partisan. And how do you see the battle over public records and whether or not they should be made available to the public? If it's not partisan, what is it?
If it's not partisan, it's public. It's all about accountability. It's one thing I really love about doing the Transparency Project is I don't have to care about what kind of records are being sought or if the person on the other side of the V in the lawsuit has a D or an R after their name. I've worked with people getting records about police brutality, and I've worked with people getting records about critical race theories. I love that I'm able to help out anybody for any issue they've got with government, because that's ideally it should be a bipartisan issue, although as you were alluding to in the intro, it's sometimes a bipartisan push against transparency in government. So, well, for example, in Wisconsin, the individual legislators are exempt from not the records law itself, but from retention laws. They can literally destroy and delete any record they have for any reason they want to at any point.
They wrote that for themselves, right?
They did, yes.
How long has that been on the books? That seems to at least go against what you would imagine to be the intent of open records laws, that they could just get rid of these when they decide to. Where'd this come from?
That's been around since the open records law itself was written back in the early 1980s. It's technically not part of the records law itself, although that it does appear in the same chapter in those state statutes, but it's a different provision about record retention. That's something I get into confusion or trouble with, is that the open records law does not help you if they don't have the record that you want. It can't be used to make them create records that they're supposed to create or keep records that they were not supposed to delete. Once it's gone and out of their possession, they don't have to turn it over anymore because it's not there.
So would this caveat or carve out in any way aid the defenses of Michael Gableman or Robin Voss in their failure to turn over documents?
So that's one of the things they tried to argue. The problem there is twofold. One is it doesn't apply to contractors. Contractors are still required to keep all their records. Number two is it only applies to individual legislators. So your senator, your assembly person, they can delete their own records. The legislature or the assembly, the Senate, the bodies themselves, that exception that allows them to delete records doesn't apply there. So the whole body's records still have to be kept. And as we've heard from the court cases, these judges have been directly ordering Gableman and the Office of Special Counsel not to delete their records for that reason. Specifically, you are not permitted to do that.
Well, Justice Gableman testified that he did delete records from his probe of the 2020 election. How common is this, Tom?
Really hard to say, because you don't know what you don't know, right? If they don't have the records, very often they just say, we don't have responsive records. You don't often get them admitting that they actually deleted stuff. You have the kind of unusual situation here where you've got the custodian on the stand under oath answering questions.
Yeah, I would be curious. Tom Kamenick, president and founder of the Wisconsin Transparency Project, also in the news recently, the story of the Secret Service cell phones over January 6th and missing text messages across the board. The defense from the Secret Service is they were changing technologies and lost a lot of information over that time. But there is still some question about that data from the Secret Service on the day of January 6th in question, the text messages that have gone missing since then. I'd just like to get your reaction to all that, Tom.
Well, we're talking about FOIA here, the Federal Freedom of Information Act, which is different than Wisconsin's and all other state laws. I'm not an expert in that a lot because it's actually a lot more difficult to file lawsuits. The FOIA only applies to executive branch agencies, which basically anything in the alphabet soup that starts with department or agency, anything like that. But it is something you see in Wisconsin, too, is the deletion of records or the accidental loss of records because of technology. There was a talk, if you recall, about what was the name? I'm not going to use the name because I might get it wrong live and I don't want to do that. But a state official who was on a board who was deleting or using an app that deleted records, deleted communications immediately after they were made, and that becomes a problem. Is even if it's illegal, there's not a whole lot you can do about it because those messages are gone.
Let's go to the phones and your questions for our guest, president and founder of the Wisconsin Transparency Project, Tom Kamenick. Join us at 1-800-642-1234, where Steve is standing by from Sun Prairie. Steve, good morning. You're on the air with Tom Kamenick.
Hi. We had a situation in our school district where we were looking for books that were purchased in the past year. And they were claiming, while they had the records, they had ignorance. They didn't know how to get the records. I was wondering if that's a valid defense, the ignorance of knowing how to get the records.
Have you heard that before, Tom?
That's a strange one. It might be the case that they don't have a single list of all the books that were purchased. Are these being purchased at different schools by different teachers? One thing that can cause difficulties with record requests is if it requires a lot of people, a lot of different employees to look through records, that can get pretty expensive for search fees. But there are some laws on the books in the state about school districts having to keep lists of their curricular textbooks. So theoretically, those should exist. And if they don't exist, there's at least an argument that you shouldn't have to pay to create them if the law was requiring them to be done already.
Tom Kamenick, we're running out of time, about a minute left, but what are you working on next?
I've got actually a case about those investigation denials. I haven't filed it yet, so I can't give the complete details, but I've got a police department that for years has just been repeatedly denying requests and saying nothing more than open investigation or active investigation. One of the requirements in the open records law is that when they do deny your request, they're supposed to explain in a fair amount of detail why and what law allows them to do so that you know whether or not that this is a valid denial. So at least you can do a little research. The state attorney general puts out a compliance guide that's a really good resource and is very approachable for non-attorneys as well to look through and see what kind of denials are allowed and which ones aren't allowed. So if people go to the Office of Open Government on the Wisconsin Department of Justice's website, they've got great compliance guide to help you out and take a look at that.
Hey, Tom, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
It's been a pleasure.
Tom Kamenick, president and founder of the Wisconsin Transparency Project, a law firm dedicated to strict enforcement of the state's open records and open meetings laws. Just ahead, we're going to be browsing through Wisconsin's indie bookstores across the state. Be interested to know what your favorite bookshop is and why you love it so. That's coming up next after the news. You're listening to the State Capitol Report, and I'm Lee Rayburn on The Morning Show.